identity is a major problem. This impacts the identity case and gives us something to go on when the person wears a mask or blindfolds the victim, which many times happens in a stranger-on-stranger rape situation, and we don't have a description, or the victim doesn't know who this person is. This would give us a place to start.
Yeah. Oh, excuse me. Is Senator Brennan, will you finish?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dale, in a forcible rape situation, and I'm trying to get some idea of how much this is used or maybe the potential. When there has been a forcible rape or sodomy, is it a usual procedure? Do you ever analyze semen to get this DNA information? Is that done regularly or?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Hill. What would happen now is that that is part of a regular rape examination. We will take or ask a doctor to take swabs of the different body cavities that may be involved. Those sample swabs are then kept by the crime lab until we have an identified suspect that we could then take a blood sample from and then run a comparison of the blood type of the defendant with the blood type information that we develop from the seminal fluid or whatever we recover from the body of the victim. That is blood typing, and that is presently used extensively in paternity testings and support enforcement cases as well as criminal cases. However, statistically, the best that can do is it can bring you down to subgroupings, and the best you can come down to is that this defendant is within a particular blood grouping that would have been consistent with the semen or the fluid that was left with the victim, but there may be thousands of people in that subclass. The thing that's important about DNA research is that it brings it down not to a subclass, but to a specific individual. This would allow us to go that next step.
I'm just trying to follow me, Chair. So in other words, now when you take that first, when you take this sample, from a victim, you cannot get down that far to DNA.
Madam Chair and Senator Hill, we could, but we don't have. This is a comparison test,
okay.
So we have to have some comparison matter to work from. This database provides us with the comparison material to then go and say, here is the DNA workup from the victim. Do we have that same DNA workup in our data bank?
Well, see, what I was saying is that if this would only provide that if a person is convicted.
Correct.
If someone is arrested for a sex crime, I don't know how long it takes someone to get convicted, but I'm just saying it. You'd have a larger database. That's
certainly. And that's correct. And I, Senator Hill, I suppose the reasoning at this point is that we want to be careful that we ensure that we protect everyone's rights. And this is a step to initiate this. And perhaps there's a desire to make sure that it works appropriately. And perhaps in the future, there's always the ability to expand it if the legislature feels that's appropriate.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
this is a question not only for Mr. Penn, but for perhaps others who might wish to address it. I'm just pondering whether this might have some deterrent effect. I don't know to what extent sexual offenders, those who commit sex crimes, are deterred from that behavior because they may be caught. But if there is anything to that, I would think knowing that they've got your genetic fingerprint in the blood and the on the database might act as a deterrent to future crimes. And if there's anything to that, it seems to me we are taking a pretty long step toward reducing the number of sex crimes.
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, I believe that's a very important aspect of this bill. We didn't mention that, but you have other bills that talk about sex offender registration. The whole idea there is the deterrent effect that if you have to go to the police and register that you're living in the community, you're less likely to commit a crime there. Well, this is even better than that because it's basically an eyewitness that can tell us if you went and committed that crime.
Okay, other questions? Thank you. Oh.
Oops. Dale, as I understand this, it would permit use of this evidence for any subsequent crime that the person may be accused of. For example, if they're involved in a burglary or you know, they left some evidence, blood or what have you, at the scene, mm-hmm. this evidence could then be called in for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you give me some idea, say, in Marion County, how many juveniles you folks may prosecute in a given year, say, for sex abuse too, or contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor, or, say, sexual misconduct, which is a C misdemeanor, who would be covered by this?
Madam Chair and Senator Springer, I can't give you those figures on the top of my head. They aren't large numbers, but perhaps it's even a more serious problem when you talk about a juvenile offender who is doing sexual offenses as a juvenile. That becomes a very difficult problem to deal with that person, to treat them and prevent them from becoming the serial rapist later on. I don't think they're large numbers, but I couldn't give them to you off the top of my head.
Okay, and just a last question. Page 2 of the bill speaks to when this information may be released, and I'm looking down at line 37 and 38 and 39, and I guess it provides that the person from whom the information is and the sample has been obtained can get that, except or unless there's a reasonable likelihood that the release of the information would prejudice a pending criminal investigation. Would you interpret that to apply to this same first person or anybody else that may be, any other kind of criminal investigation that may be going on? In other words, if a person wanted this data to exonerate themselves, could they get it at an early investigative stage and say, hey, I know this is on file, I didn't do it, I want to see my results so I can prove to you it wasn't me?
Certainly, Madam Chair and Senator Springer, I think the way this would operate is that this is basically setting up a procedure, and I suppose under the public records law, anyone could request this. They know that this has taken place, so they want that material to utilize themselves. There is an exemption under public records law for a pending and open investigation, criminal investigation. This tends to bring in that same language. We would have to go before a circuit judge and show that, yes, Your Honor, this should not be given for this reason. And a circuit judge is going to make that decision. And obviously, if someone's a suspect or been charged with a crime, that information is going to be available.
Well, I'm talking even before the charge, in the phase of the investigation, say you've got two brothers, and mm-hmm. who knows, other evidence or other circumstances may be such that one or both could have been present, and the one says, hey, no, it was the other dude, not me, mm-hmm. and I want to prove that. Do you think there would probably be access to that information, notwithstanding this?
Yes, Senator Springer. I can't imagine that being withheld. But even if it was withheld, there is that procedure that I believe that could be ordered by the court to release it. I can't imagine that not happening.
Thank you.
Thanks. Anyone else? Thank you, Dale.
Thank you.
Let's call up Captain, is it Brooks from the mm-hmm. State Police? First question, is this anticipated in your budget, which is downstairs?
The only portion of our budget.
You need to get your name on the record.
I'm sorry.
From me. They don't trust me.
Yes, and Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, I'm Captain Rich Brook, the Oregon State Police Crime Laboratory. The only thing we have in our base budget as it relates to DNA, we do have a package for $30,000 on capital outlay equipment.
Okay, so you do have $30,000, and this needs to get down to Ways and Means, or it needs to be voted as an expenditure limitation part or something, because it's not in the budget.
That is correct. This, the equipment we purchased, Mr. Chairperson, we are going to be utilizing that $30,000, hopefully, to assist with the this proposal also.
Right, but and you do have, do you run DNA testing for investigative purposes now on a routine, well, when requested, I should say, are you set up to do it, and do you do it in-house here? This is a banking situation where you actually have to keep the records and figure out a way you're going to deal with that, but what happens now? Tell us a little bit about how much of this kind of work you do right now.
Okay, currently we are not doing any DNA testing at all.
You send them out?
Yes, correct. Basically, we're assisting the law enforcement agencies as far as the mechanics on sending them out either to private concerns or back to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who have just initiated their testing on casework in November of last year. Currently, we have I have one person just returning from the FBI who's been back for 4 months going through their extensive training program, and we plan to actually have this in focus January 1990.
January 1990 with $30,000 and one person from your lab who has sort of taken some training and will be prepared to perform these tests or supervise the collection of samples and organizing of samples so that some other lab will run them. I'm interested to know what you're planning, how you're planning to put this, actually do them.
Very good. Madam Chairman, we have attended a number of international forensic conferences as it relates to DNA starting about a year and a half ago. Currently, as I mentioned before, I do have one person going through a four-month extensive training program. We will be sending two people back to FBI again for refresher school the month of July. In the meantime, members of the crime laboratory have taken courses in molecular biology to augment their training in DNA analysis. DNA, although it's a very technical field, the actual process themselves is not that tricky. It's the test associated court testimony and knowing the statistical data and so forth when it comes to court is where it is takes a little bit more expertise. But we feel very comfortable that we're doing a very slow, methodical process to make sure that when the testing we do on casework or on biological samples is 100% accurate.
Could you help us with, and we'll try to get this from other places too, if we required that every person in jail who was convicted of these type of offenses would be required to send sample to the bank as well, we're interested, we will need to have some assessment of it, of another fiscal impact statement that would bring this to mind and see what we're looking at here.
And, very good. Once I get the data, I'd like to...
Knowing that. Since there has been an amendment offered to include all of the people who were in jail custody as well as in addition to the people who are in custody in the Corrections Department. Senator Hill.
Oh, yes, I guess... Your second part of your statement, I guess, takes into what I was. In other words, anyone who's been arrested for a crime, a sex crime as well, Madam Chair, was that the last part of your question?
No, I said convicted.
Oh, convicted.
But no, in the jails.
Oh, convicted. Madam Chair,
in
I didn't
your
know
jail, if you're in the jail yes. population and
you've been convicted
of a misdemeanor, then I'm interested in finding out what the larger number is. With respect to the amendment that's been offered on line 5.
Yes, Madam Chair, so maybe this is sort of a futuristic
discussion
here. What I want to ask is, anyone who has been arrested for a sex crime, I would like to know about. And I don't know how many people are arrested for sex crimes, and this may, Madam Chair, be far beyond the purview of economic that we want to go, but just out of curiosity, anyone who's been arrested for a sex crime, how much of a fiscal impact that would be as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, basically the major cost as it relates to DNA typing is that it is very labor intensive. They can only, one trained individual at this time can only do 30 to 35 samples per month. However, once arrested, and we put it into the database, we will never have to do it again, since the DNA never does change in a specific individual.
So just keep that in mind. One person
yes.
for 35 samples per month. One person can do 35 samples a month.
And I guess, Madam Chair, it just depends on how many people
we want to hire
are represented, or how many people per month are arrested for
right.
sex
That's
crimes.
Right.
I don't have that idea. But I guess the thing that we're getting to is that if someone who tends to do these things on a frequent basis, it's just kind of a shame that we have to wait for them to be convicted in order to have them
see,
in the database.
But you could put them. That's not true. If someone, Captain Brooks is going to
see if I'm right. If you can still order, the DA can still order an investigation on someone who has been arrested and compare that with a data bank. And I'm assuming that when and if that person is convicted, that same information will be transferred to the permanent data bank. So that it's not as if they're preempted and I see Dale Penn shaking his head, from the district attorney's, he's shaking his head, yes, from calling for these tests in the investigative stages for someone who in fact has been arrested. It's just that we're not blanket going to demand that every one of them goes in this time on a database, on the data bank.
Madam Chair, just a comment on that. If you were to allow this to be done upon an arrest and it were to go into the data bank, then you'd be subjecting people who were arrested but not convicted of suspicion for future crimes based upon an arrest which did not result in a conviction. So as I sort of think through the implications of doing it on an arrest, I do see problems.
You take the thing.
Yeah.
What it is, it would be useful to see what the fiscal impact is going to be. And the fact, I think you got people on the committee here who are supportive of building the data bank. And right now the question is beginning to do that and the fiscal impact. And we do need, at least for my purposes, a comparison of those who are in the jails as well as those who are in the prison system. Any other comments? Thank you. Okay, let's move to Senate Bill. What would you? 405. Dale Penn is the only person here for Senate Bill 405. Come on up, Dale. We're on Senate Bill 405.
I should mention there is a letter in your files from Jack Ransom of Ransom Blackman Simpson representing the American Civil Liberties Union that just came in by Federal Express late this morning.
Maybe on 1163?
On Senate Bill 405.
My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I have passed out to the committee members a Xerox copy of a statute, 813-160, and the subsection that I draw your attention to is subsection 2 on the left-hand column. If you examine that subsection, you will see that Senate Bill 405 is basically that language, except that it does not confine itself to implied consent situations. And what I'd like to do is give you the reason for this bill, respond to some criticisms that Mr. Ransom provides to you in his letter, and tell you what we're trying to accomplish. The bottom line is that civil liability is a major concern to doctors and hospitals and nurses. They're very concerned about that, maybe as much as anything. And district attorneys and police officers run into problems when we ask medical personnel to take blood samples or to do medical tests or procedures on defendants who may be in custody. I have had many times where I've had to make a phone call at 3 a.m. because there's a new phlebotomist that was hired at a hospital or a new ER doctor or change in policy or someone just decides, gee, I want to have a court order, I want to have a piece of paper in front of me that tells me that I'm not going to be sued if I take this blood sample or if I take an x-ray of this defendant. A doctor shouldn't have to worry about whether or not a police officer is doing his job. This is a situation where we're asking the legislature to extend immunity that has already been provided under implied consent law. That's Chapter 813, 160, sub 2. In a drunk driving prosecution, the legislature has already said, if you take blood or examine blood for blood alcohol in a drunk drive case, you have civil immunity as long as you do it at the direction of a police officer and you do it in a medically acceptable manner. So that if the police officer has made a mistake and doesn't have probable cause or whatever, there is someone who's going to be responsible for that. That local government unit is going to have to pay damages if someone's rights have been violated. There is no reason to hook in a doctor who simply withdrew the blood at the request of the police officer, and he did it in a medically acceptable manner. We have taken that and developed Senate Bill 405 to apply in situations other than drunk drive cases. Because now we run into the problem that lawyers who represent hospitals will say, hey, we need to take a blood sample. This is an assault case, or this is a manslaughter case. It involves driving under the influence, but it's not going to be prosecuted as that. It is something much more serious. And they say, but we don't have immunity. We want a court order, or we want a search warrant right now. You heard testimony last week about the Supreme Court's bill, or Justice Jones' bill, to have kind of dial a search warrant and in this county and others. We don't have that right now, and the reality is that it takes hours to prepare a search warrant, find a judge, and get it signed. When you're talking about dissipation of alcohol and blood, those hours are extremely significant. So this would allow a doctor to follow a request of a police officer, and as long as that medical test is done in a medically acceptable manner, then they have civil immunity. And the law enforcement agency would be liable if there is any problems there. This would apply primarily in x-rays, blood samples, that type of thing. There may be some other tests that it would apply to, but that's the main purpose, is those. In looking at Mr. Ransom's letter, he stated that, why do we need this? Well, we need it because of the fear of civil liability by doctors and hospitals, and there, many of them will refuse to take a blood sample without a piece of paper, and that is not always possible, and it creates friction between our agencies and yelling and all kinds of stuff, threats, because we have to gather that evidence right then. He states that maybe present law already protects medical personnel. It does not. There is no immunity provision that I know of in the law other than Chapter 813, which only provides civil immunity in implied consent drunk drive prosecutions. This would allow it in other kinds of cases. There is concern that perhaps in some situations a doctor should be able to say, no, I'm not going to do this procedure because medically it would endanger the life of the individual. And I don't have any problems with amending this bill to give an out to a doctor to say that if there is serious problems with some mechanism, although we're primarily talking about drawn blood, that the doctor could say, no, this would endanger the life, so I'm not going to follow this. You still have to go get a court order. I don't have any problems with amending it to deal with that situation. The rest of the criticisms that are in place on page 2 and 3 of Mr. Ransom's letter deal with the concept that we shouldn't be taking evidence from people without having probable cause. I agree. And all of those safeguards are still in place, and this case law is still valid. It's just that the doctor doesn't have to be a lawyer and decide whether or not you have sufficient probable cause, because he's not going to be sued as long as he does this in a medically acceptable manner. Now, the police officer and the district attorney still has to be worried about page 2 and page 3, because we can't be taking things or taking samples from defendants without having probable cause and an exigent circumstance that authorizes that. All of those safeguards are still in place. This simply carves out civil immunity for a physician if they obey a request from a police officer and they do the test in a medically acceptable manner, then they are immune. That's all this accomplishes. And I think that except for the perhaps one amendment to allow an out in a life-threatening situation, which I've never come up against myself, but I don't have any problem with having that out in the bill. I believe we've addressed all the concerns that Mr. Ransom states in his letter.
Yeah.
So you'd agree that it's quite clear that the doctor, the nurse, or whatever would be acting as an agent of the police officer, so we're not going to have deputy DAs going into court saying this was an independent and so exclusionary rules don't apply. They do apply, right?
No, and this requires, under the direction or control,
at the request of the peace officer.
Right, right.
So no doubt that they're acting as an agent.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Senator Schumer.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair.
it, of course, would be improper for the police officer, assuming he's medically qualified, to take a blood test without a search warrant. Right?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, no, that's not correct. Present law allows, because of the dissipation in the blood of alcohol, it dissipates at a certain rate. The Supreme Court has ruled that there is an automatic exigent circumstance. And this is ancient law from Schmerber versus California, really, just that Oregon just adopted that really in the last year and a half. So that if they have probable cause that someone was driving and they may be under the influence, then that's sufficient probable cause to take a blood sample. The difficulty is that most police officers are not medically trained to take blood samples, so we have to always go to some medical personnel to do that in a medically acceptable manner. And that's where we run into the problem, because the officer is saying, here I am, I got probable cause, I want a blood sample or I want an x-ray or whatever happens, and the physician says, I'm concerned that I'll get sued because this guy's saying he doesn't want a blood sample, and so I want to have a piece of paper that says I don't get sued, otherwise I'm not doing anything. And that's where we get into the problem.
As you are aware, in fact you mentioned it, we heard last week a bill that would allow search warrants upon a telephone call to an appropriate judge. And I think one of the purposes of that is to have more search warrants and less searches on probable cause.
Mm-hmm.
If that bill were to pass, would you be comfortable that that would provide sufficient protection so that we wouldn't need this?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, the difficulty is that bill is a pilot project. My county is one of the counties that would be involved. It only applies part-time. It only applies on evenings and weekends when those judges are on call. There are a lot of difficulties. We don't know that it's going to work out. I must tell you, there are tremendous practical problems about whether or not that will work. We're willing to try it and see. Eventually, if that worked and it went statewide, and I don't know how long that will take to get to that point, yeah, that would probably do away with this need. But we have at least 2 years and maybe more before we would know how that project will work out.
Another question. You have repeatedly said that the physicians now insist upon seeing the piece of paper, the search warrant or the court order. Would it do the job if that were not required, but they would have to satisfy, you know, they would have to be told by a reliable person that there is a probable cause, or that there is a search warrant, or that there is a court order? In other words, they can't simply go in and do what they're told without making some independent inquiry. And if the police officer says, assures them that there is a search warrant or assures them that there's probable cause, that then that would be, they could use that as a defense against any subsequent suit. How would that do?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, that effectively is what this bill does. But it shortcuts that.
It doesn't require the physician to ascertain, you know, to ask the question.
Certainly. Because that physician is in no position to make that judgment.
No, he has to do is ask the police officer or the DA, do you have probable cause here?
I don't.
Do you have a search warrant?
Sure. I don't have any problem with saying the physician should inquire and be assured there's probable cause. The only difficulty I have is if the doctor is going to make that decision. Is that sufficient probable cause or not? Because what happens now is they will say at 3 o'clock in the morning, I want to wait until 10 o'clock tomorrow when I can call so-and-so in Portland.
I understand the problem.
That's the difficulty.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Springer first.
Yes.
Do you have a question?
I just want to make sure I understand. There's reference in the letter we received from Mr. Ransom's office that presumably this could apply to a stomach pump situation. Or am I correct that Supreme Court law speaks otherwise?
In a drug case, someone ingests
the evidence, you go in and the officer hauls the person down and says, I want you to stomach pump this person because I think they may have consumed controlled substances.
Yeah, that would be possible. When I say x-rays, the situation I have that comes to mind is I had a man in a murder case that swallowed two jewels that were stolen from the victims, and they're like this. And we took an x-ray to establish where they were, and then we made arrangements to recover those gems. But there could be the situation